Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the recent landmark Supreme Court decision on healthcare with Azeez Huq, a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. While liberals are celebrating the Roberts ruling, he argues in an article at The Nation, in the healthcare decision, a hidden threat, that there are idiosyncratic libertarian ideals inserted in the law that could explode into much larger and more harmful doctrines. Then we'll go to London to investigate a series of banking scandals involving muni bond bid rigging that enabled bankers and traders to rob the public to create bonuses for themselves. Economist Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University, joins us to discuss the latest financial scandal that may be the tip of another iceberg the titans of Wall Street are heading for. Then we will go to Oaxaca, Mexico, to speak with Fabian Tepper, an independent journalist who witnessed massive protests in the town square yesterday when students and workers who wanted to vote for the PRD candidate López Obrador were denied ballots. Then finally, we will speak with an official observer who is monitoring the Mexican elections, Pamela Starr, the director of the U.S.-Mexico Network at USC and a former professor of Latin American political economy at the private university ITAM in Mexico City. She has an article at foreignpolicy.com, What Mexico's Election Means for the War on Drugs. Joining us now is Azeez Huq, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. He has an article at The Nation, in the healthcare decision, A Hidden Threat. Welcome to Background Briefing, Azeez Huq.
Hi, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And as I mentioned in the opening, you have this article in which you say that while liberals are celebrating the Roberts ruling, there are idiosyncratic libertarian ideals inserted in the law that could explode into much larger and more harmful doctrines. So elaborate, if you will.
That's absolutely right, Ian. I think it's really important to begin by saying that the law, that the decision last week is a really big victory, not just for Obama, but for the tens of thousands of people who've already been able to access health care and the millions more who will get health care as a consequence of the decision to uphold the law. That's an enormously big deal, and I don't mean to underplay that. When I refer to a hidden threat in the article, what I mean is that there are sections of the court's reasoning that are part of the binding law that will, in the future, impose new constraints upon Congress's ability to pass legislation, programs that are designed to mitigate social risks, and that also imperils presently enacted programs that are meant to provide parts of the social safety net.
Well, you mentioned in your article at The Nation that there is an analogy here or a comparison here with the famous Marbury versus Madison decision of 1803 that lay dormant like a loaded gun for a long time. So tell us about what is dormant in this and what is likely to explode at some time in the future.
Yeah, so in Marbury v. Madison, the Supreme Court with the great early Chief Justice John Marshall writing basically said that it had the power to invalidate federal laws, but it used that power in a way that denied the administration at the time, Thomas Jefferson's administration, the ability to make the court an object of political vilification. Basically, it said we're striking down a law that gives us the power to issue a remedy in this case. Therefore, Thomas Jefferson wins, but in winning, he had to accept the court's ability to strike down laws. And something similar happened in this case, in the sense that the court, and in particular, the part of the opinion that Chief Justice Roberts wrote, that is the legally operative part of the court's judgment, the court upheld the individual mandate, saying that it was authorized as a tax. But Chief Justice Roberts was very careful to say that In so doing, he was imposing constraints on the Commerce Clause, which is an important part of Congress's repertoire of constitutional tools to get things done. And in another part of the opinion that I think has not yet received as much attention as it ought to, he said that the court would uphold the Affordable Care Act's extension of Medicaid, which is a social security type program that is operated largely by the states and works through grants by the federal government to the states. But that as conditions on that grant, the federal government imposes certain requirements and restrictions upon states that are meant to ensure that the really most needy benefit from the money that the federal government gives to the states for Medicaid. The court said it was going to uphold the expansion of Medicaid using that spending power that the Congress has, but that it was imposing a new limit on that spending power. And this is the real core, I think, of what's troubling about the healthcare decisions. The court limited the federal government's power to give money to the states and to impose conditions upon those grants. Congress has used its ability to give money with strings attached over the course of the last 50 years to enact a whole series of really important regulatory safety net type programs. And these range from education programs, so actually No Child Left Behind was a conditional spending program. Many of our civil rights laws are conditional spending programs. So Title IX, which is the law that protects against sex discrimination in education, is conditional spending. And Title VI, which is the law that requires recipients of federal grants to refrain from racial discrimination, is also conditional spending. The court's decision creates a new basis for states and other recipients of federal grants to argue that they have the right to take federal money but not to comply with the federal conditions that come with it. And that really does, if it was aggressively interpreted, and we don't know how it'll be interpreted, but if aggressively interpreted, has the real potential to undermine a lot of important both regulatory anti-discrimination laws and social safety net laws.
Again, I'm speaking with Aziz Haque, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and he has an article at The Nation in the healthcare decision, A Hidden Threat. And specifically, we're talking about the Commerce Clause that is the central plank of congressional authority. It came into being under Roosevelt against tremendous states' rights resistance, and it has become the framework or the enabler of such things as the Environmental Protection Act and a lot of civil rights laws. And what you're arguing here, Aziz Haque, is that the Roberts decision has opened up new limitations on the Commerce Clause that you don't consider, we've seen anything like this until the Republican Party embraced these Tea Party ideas, that, and this could be the seed that could unravel important benefits of the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, well, so I should be clear that there are two important congressional powers at stake. One is the Commerce Clause and the other is the Spending Clause. In the healthcare decision, a majority of the court imposes new limits on both the Commerce Clause and the Spending Clause, and both of those are very important federal grants of authority. The limit on the Commerce Clause is probably going to be not as important for reasons that I can explain if you want. The limit, though, on the Spending Clause, which is the issue that actually nobody really paid attention to as the case was running up, and it was sort of an addendum to the Supreme Court's oral arguments, and it kind of has fallen away in the backdrop. But the court's opinion on the Spending Clause and the limits imposed on the Spending Clause, I think, have a real potential to be disruptive, both of previously enacted laws like Title VI and Title IX, and also, I think it has the real potential to undermine Congress's ability to use its ability to spend to impose important regulatory mandates on the states moving forward.
So what is, you're suggesting that this is a new kind of dormant authority, that if it's pursued aggressively, it could really change the nature of the power of government.
That's right. Congress has always had the ability to collect tax money and to use that tax money by giving it to the states and saying, states, you can take this, but you have to follow the following rules. For example, you can't engage in sex discrimination in a public university. You can't run a classroom that's racially discriminatory. You can't, we're going to give you money for highways, but you have to construct your highways and your transportation system in a way that's environmentally friendly and that comports with the goals of environmental policy. The Supreme Court in the healthcare decision said for the very first time that a condition imposed on spending was unconstitutional because it coerced the state. The court's decision does not have a crisp or clear definition of what it means to coerce a state unconstitutionally. That idea it's kind of floated around in some Supreme Court cases, particularly in the 1930s, but this is the first time that it's been used to invalidate something. And precisely because it's a powerful idea, it's an idea that is very poorly conceptualized, very unclear in this healthcare decision itself, and it's very subjective, right? What it means to be put under pressure that is, unfair somehow is very much in the eye of the beholder. For example, one of the things that Chief Justice Roberts says in the healthcare case is, well, you know, the states here were coerced because they were offered so much money, right? So the coercion comes from the lure of the federal dollars. There were so many federal dollars at stake that they couldn't resist it, right? So that this is a very odd and potentially powerful and disruptive theory that goes to an important federal power, the power to raise money and then to spend it by giving it to states and to impose conditions on those federal grants to states, a power that's been used to create all sorts of important regulatory programs in the civil rights field, in the education field, in the environmental field, and many other areas.
Well, but the idea of coercion as a lure, as though it's some sort of prostitute beckoning you into a dark corridor, it's almost like the Twinkie defense. It has a peculiar, unreal quality to it.
Well, this is right. This is right. The court basically said that the states have become so dependent upon federal money for Medicaid that it would be unconstitutional to deny them that money moving forward. So I presume if, and it's a very odd decision because it suggests that somehow states have an entitlement to whatever money they were getting last year as Medicaid funds into the future, right? And we all know that's not how federal appropriations work. Federal appropriations are done anew every year. We don't know what's going to be the case for, you know, federal appropriations a year, 2 years, 3 years from now. And yet, the court's opinion makes it seem as if there's almost an entitlement on the part of the states.
And these are states, by the way, who have sued to strike down the Affordable Care Act, and they've made a very clear statement that they don't want the federal money. They want nothing to do with the federal government in this regard.
Well, to be fair to the states, what they want is they want the money, but they don't want any of the conditions. They just want cash, and they say, look, we ought to have this cash, and it ought to be for us to decide what to do with it. And this is of course in line with the kind of Paul Ryan plan for block grants to the states in lieu of federal regulatory programs that direct how money is going to be spent.
Well, as I say, it strikes me as a kind of weird dog ate my homework argument. I'm astounded when you explain it to me. Just in closing, though, Aziz Haq, your your former boss that you clerked for, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she noticed this, did she not, in the decision, and put up a very cogent defense.
That's right. And Justice Ginsburg writes in the healthcare decisions an opinion that is for herself and for a number of the other justices that explains both why the court's new limitation on the Commerce Clause and also its new theory of coercion with respect to the Spending Clause are both unmoored. They don't have a basis in previous precedent. And moreover, I think she very sort of nicely points out they're illogical. And she has some very cogent critiques of the internal logic of Chief Justice Roberts's opinions. And it's rather inside baseball, but people who really want to sort of get a handle on kind of what's going on in those opinions, I think the Justice Ginsburg's opinion is a great place to start, although I'm obviously biased.
Well, but I think what you're suggesting here and what people should really pay attention to is that this may be a hollow victory if indeed the Supreme Court justice didn't want to be that radical to strike down a sitting president's signature legislation, at the same time put in a poison pill that may have the same result if it's exploited later.
I don't think it's a hollow victory because I do think that the Affordable Care Act is not going to be invalidated on constitutional grounds, and there are thousands, if not millions, of people who will receive health care as a consequence of this decision who would otherwise not get it. So that I think, is not going to change. What's going to change is sometime in the future, there is the potential for the court, with respect to other laws, to invoke parts of this opinion in ways that compromise the constitutionality of those other laws. So I would expect, for example, to see aggressive attacks by states on laws like Title VI and Title IX, which are conditional funding grants that impose anti-discrimination mandates. I would expect to see those challenges coming down the pike, and I think that the opinion in the healthcare cases lays the groundwork for invalidating or compromising those programs, which I think is a really big deal.
Well, it sounds like a gift to Rand Paul. It's actually quite a disturbing possibility. And I thank you for joining us here today, Aziz Haque.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Aziz Haque, who is a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He is a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. He has an article at The Nation in the healthcare decision, A Hidden Threat. We're going to take a brief station break and then we'll go to London to talk about the latest financial scandal. I've got it all, almost. I've got it all, almost all. Figured out, but always when I get there.